Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.
Shrink Wrap Radio number 177, a live presentation on technology and the millennials, October 11th, 2008. Welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio, the planet's premier psychology podcast. This is your host, Dr. Dave, coming to you from the San Francisco Bay Area. Shrink Wrap Radio is the show that speaks from the psychologist in me to the psychologist in you, whether you be amateur, student, or professional. Everyone, what follows is a presentation I gave yesterday at Sonoma State University. As in previous semesters, Dr. Shepard Bliss invited me to be a guest speaker in his psychology class, The Person in Society. I tried to make the session interactive, though I ended up talking more than I intended. However, you'll hear comments and reactions from a number of students in the class, as well as some very spirited rejoinders from Shepard. My comments on technology will be familiar from conversations you've heard here between me and my friend Jerry Trumbull. There are a few patches where you'll hear a buzzing sound. Unfortunately, I didn't realize the transmitter in my iPhone, which has a mind of its own, was going off periodically, causing this electrical interference. Here's the presentation. So here we are in Person and Society at Sonoma State University. And as I was saying, I've had a long-standing interest in technology and the impact of technology on society. There are certain ways in which I think technology is driving society and certain ways in which society helps to shape the technology. So it's kind of an interactive process. You all seem to have paper and pens in front of you, so let me post some questions to you to kind of help us kick off this discussion, a discussion that I'm hoping will be very interactive. So on a scale of 0 to 10, where 10 would be high, I'd like you to rate your attention span. Your grade is not going to be based on this, okay? But just where do you think your attention span is on a scale of 0 to 10, where 10 is, boy, I can really focus and I've got just a great attention span, and 0 is my mind is wandering all the time. And what did you say? And let's try another scale. Again, on 0 to 10, rate how fidgety you are, where 0 would be, which way do we want this scale to go? I guess 10 would be extremely fidgety, or you'd just be fidgeting all the time, tapping your foot. You know, sometimes people get kind of this motor leg going, right, where their leg is going or their foot is tapping, or they're tapping their pencil, they're clicking the pen on and off. They're real restless. And 0 is, I don't do any of that, I never do any of that, and all the other numbers are somewhere in between. And we'll talk about this in a minute. Why am I asking you this question? Well, there was an article in The Atlantic magazine. It used to be called The Atlantic Monthly. I think now it may just be called The Atlantic. A very provocative article that got a lot of attention, and I've already talked about it on a couple of podcasts, actually. And the title of the article, which I'm looking for right now, I know I brought it with me.
Does Google Make You Stupid?
Yes.
I actually have a handout that I passed out.
Oh, did they?
Not the whole article, but it was a columnist who wrote about it.
Okay. Great. Is Google making us stupid? And the contention by the author is what he noticed in himself is that he used to read long books with full engagement, and that what he's noticed over time is that his attention span seems to be getting shorter, and that he's doing more skimming. And he doesn't think that he could sit down and read War and Peace today in the way that he did when he was a younger man. That really hit home for me because I felt I had been thinking that I was noticing something kind of similar in myself. I'm a real technophile, if you haven't figured that out yet. I'll give you some more evidence for it as we go along. But I'm sort of wedded to this technology at the hip in many ways. And at the same time, I question it. I mean, I see both the hope and the promise, but also there is a dark side, a kind of shadow side or underbelly to all of this technology. And this kind of begins to get at some of that. When I first came to Sonoma State a long time ago, 35 years ago, I guess, something like that, when you walked around the halls, you would see professors sitting in offices talking to students, or maybe off at the tennis courts. I used to play tennis with some of my students, or interacting in other ways socially. Now when you walk around campus and you look in open office doors, what you're most likely to see is somebody staring at a computer. Check it out. I mean, does that fit with your experience? When you go to office hours, chances are your professor is looking at the computer and has to swivel around, you know, to deal with you. So things are changing. Things are changing. And so in myself, it does feel like I've got a shorter attention span. And it also has felt to me like I have less patience with people. There's something about interacting with a computer where, you know, it most of the time responds right away, and I'm in control. I can go where I want to go, look at what I want to look at, click, move on, etc. And, you know, people make jokes about the TV remote and wanting to point it at their wife or somebody, you know, to change the channel or shut them up or something like that. Do you recognize that impulse in yourself at all? I'd be curious to know what kinds of numbers did we have on the... What was my first question? It was attention span. Anybody put down a 10? Do we have any 10s? All right. Shepherd Bliss, a 10, and you had a 10. Great. So two people in a room of about, I would estimate about, 25 people in the room? How many people gave themselves a 9? No 9s. An 8? No 8s. A 7? We got about 6 or 7, 8 7s. A 6, about 4 6s. A 5, got a couple of 5s. A 4, 3, 1 3. Thank you for your honesty. Don't notice, Shepherd. A 2, a 1, a 0. Okay, no zeros, no ones. What about fidgetiness? I guess the reason I wanted to ask this, you know, is I'm interested in you. I suspect most of the people in this room fall into the category that marketers are calling the millennials, and that's about 18 to 25. So I'm wondering what it's like for you millennials who've kind of grown up with so much technology and take it for granted, because I came up in a time when there were no personal computers, there were no cell phones, there were no calculators even initially. So all of this technology has kind of happened within my lifetime so that I can look at, well, what was I like before and how has it changed me? You don't have quite that same range of experience, but I'm just curious what your experience of this technology has been. So what's your take on attention span, technology, getting on the web? Let's make this a little bit more interactive because I've been talking a lot. Somebody say something. Just raise your hand and I'll come over. Be brave. Great. And maybe say your first name too.
I'm Stephen. One of the first problems I think with technology is an accessibility problem, because in the past you wouldn't have to monitor yourself every minute of the day, but if you have a phone with the internet or a computer with wireless, you can always pull it out and access. And because you have this extra realm where you normally didn't have to control yourself, now you have to control yourself even more, but people aren't because they're not used to it.
Now, when you say control yourself, I'm not quite sure what you mean.
Like, I have a laptop, and I could bring it to school any day of the week, and I could plug in for most of my classes because they have internet jacks in them, or they have wireless, so I could ignore what the teacher's saying and just go off on the internet. Or I've been taught by friends how to war drive, which is when you drive around neighborhoods and find unprotected wireless or break into wireless connections. So you just drive around and pick up a wireless connection if you really need one, and then you just, again, go on the internet.
Okay, those are a bunch of great issues that you've raised there. The whole issue of privacy, for one thing, which is a whole area that we could go into. I was interested in what you said about control, kind of have to control yourself in terms of, it sounds like there'd be that impulse, that desire sometimes to go online rather than listen and pay attention in class, right? Yep. And so that's an interesting dynamic, you know, that wasn't there before. And what you said, what triggered for me is how compulsive I am around that stuff. When I get up in the morning, I should be more embarrassed about myself, about all of this stuff that I'm revealing. But the first thing I do when I get up in the morning is I check my email. I see a head nodding over here. I'm not alone. Anybody else like that? Totally compulsive about it. If the telephone rings, I go dashing off for the telephone. Now, I have a rationalization for that, you know, because I have a business that I run in my home. I can't afford to miss a business call. But every now and then I look at that behavior and I kind of look askance at myself. And, you know, what am I doing that I'm so driven by, you know, that I got to grab the phone like it's an emergency or something. I'm just so compulsive about it. Or I used to have a BlackBerry. Now I have an iPhone. And the BlackBerry, you know, the BlackBerry has this characteristic of constant email access. And I had it on vibrate. And so there's this interesting phenomenon of, you've heard of the phantom limb phenomenon, you know, somebody who's unfortunately experiences an amputation will often have the experience that they still have that missing limb, or they may feel pain or sensation in the missing limb. Well, there's phantom BlackBerry vibration. I was so relieved to read about that in an article in the newspaper because I had been experiencing it. And it was, oh, it's not just me. Because sometimes I would forget to have my BlackBerry and I'd feel this vibration in my pocket and it wasn't there. That's certainly some kind of level of addiction or habituation or something. I'm sort of an anachronism. You know, I've described myself as a technophile, and I'm an anachronism in a reverse way. I mean, usually anachronism means you're so stuck in the distant past that you're not present in the future. I'm sort of the other way around, trying to be in the future. So for somebody who's retired from academia now for 4 years, I am, as I've already shared with you, a podcaster with 3 podcasts. I'm on Flickr. I have a series on YouTube. I'm on Twitter. I'm on Skype. I'm on LinkedIn, Facebook. I have a Facebook page. I have a MySpace page. I've been on Second Life. I have an avatar on Second Life. What have I left out? Delicious. I have a Delicious account. I probably left something out. So as you can see, I'm sort of up to my neck in all of this technology. I hope you all will friend me. What about that? What about this whole thing about friending? Anybody on Facebook here? Let's talk about Facebook a bit. Tell us a bit about your Facebook experience. What's your name?
Ashley.
Ashley?
Yeah. I hate Facebook.
You hate Facebook. Do you have a Facebook page?
Yeah.
Okay. She has a Facebook page and she hates it. Why do you hate it?
It's just a little stupid. I have a MySpace and I like that better.
Okay.
But all my like high school friends are on my MySpace and all my SSU friends are on my Facebook. So it's kind of that I can't delete it.
You can't delete it because...
Because then half of them don't have MySpace and I just like to communicate to friends.
Okay, and are you actually communicating with friends or, you know, I have the phenomenon of people that I don't know who are asking to be friends.
I don't like that.
You don't like that?
No, they're actually my friends.
Okay. And so do you think this... do you think that this is an important vehicle that will play an important role in your life after you move on from school?
As in keeping touch,
yeah.
Possibly, yeah.
Yeah.
But it's hard enough as it is to try and keep in touch with them with, like, work and school. So, probably won't do any good to me after I'm out.
Okay. Okay. Any other experiences or comments about Facebook or MySpace? Yeah, good. Hi, what's your name?
Yanina. I just wanted to say that MySpace oftentimes also used for like networking, which a lot of people don't realize. So I used to be one of those people. I used to have over like 500 friends, and I could not like remember any of their names. I didn't know what they looked like in person. But a lot of times you have to have connections in life, and I feel like at that point in time, that's what I used it for. So I think there's multiple uses.
Okay. Well, of course, one of the uses, and I don't know how much thought you give to this, is Facebook is a major tool for marketing to you, that you represent a prime commercial target that people are concerned about reaching. And there's real panic in the advertising industry because it's clear that people in many ways have migrated away from television and aren't consuming media in the same ways that they used to due to the advent of combination of TiVo and, you know, video recorders generally, and then all of this alternative media, podcasts, videocasts, etc. And so there was an article recently in last month in Business Week. Let me just read you a little bit about this. Evidently, they are doing something that I hadn't heard of before called pre-rewards. Is that what they're called? Or pre-cards? Tim Kendall, Facebook's director of monetization, calls the ad service highly efficient. Once small businesses pay a premium, which usually ranges from 48 cents to 62 cents per click, or 22 cents to 29 cents per thousand impressions, they can advertise to ideal demographics. If you own a toy store, for example, you can market Star Wars gear to sci-fi junkies. If you're a jeweler in Atlanta, you can target local women ages 18 and over who list diamonds as an interest. Does it work? According to Andy Dunn, CEO and co-founder of Bonobos.com, an online trouser store, there's no better marketing tool. In March, Dunn spent $64 peddling royal blue pants to Facebook's 50,000 Chicago Cubs fans. Official Cubs colors are royal blue and red. Within days, Bonobos had sold 12 pairs and netted $1,300. The company's follow-up campaigns, red pants to Boston Red Sox fans, orange pants to Syracuse University alumni, brought even bigger success. For better or worse, Skay says millennials are willing to share themselves with the world, and more important, advertisers. That said, they're not easily exploited. The second Edo's pre-ward, that's what they're calling them, pre-wards, where it's kind of like a coupon that you get. Has anybody gotten any of these pre-wards? I think it's like a card that you get or something where you'll get like a dollar off if you go to this business or that business or $2 off. Evidently, this is the new big thing because they're saying pre-reward notifications start to resemble spam or Facebook's Uber ads become too intrusive. Young adults will readily shut them out. As Skay explains, this isn't a very forgiving demographic. You're not a forgiving demographic, it turns out. Kendall isn't too worried, though. As millennials gain spending power, he says these granular marketing tactics offer a viable alternative to TV spots and neighborhood flyers, especially for small businesses. Suter, the 16-year-old face card user from Nashville, couldn't agree more. I don't mind coupons, he says, but I'd rather use a pre-ward. So that's just a little bit from a longer article in Newsweek. So I guess one of the things that we need to be aware of in using tools like Facebook and so on is that all of that information is public and all of it is being mined by advertisers. It's all being cataloged and it's all can be explored and cross-referenced and so on. And the concept of privacy is really, really changing. What do you all think about privacy? Are you concerned about your privacy, or do you figure it's just kind of gone, so why even worry about it? We have the same sets of hands. Here's a new hand, though. Yeah, your name?
Camille.
Camille?
Yeah, I'm just nervous sometimes when I put up pictures on my MySpace. If somebody were to take a picture off there, and put a different body on or something.
Yeah.
Because there's a lot of that kind of stuff going on, so I get kind of nervous about what I put up there.
Yeah, and indeed you should be. As you may know, employers these days, potential employers, they go to your MySpace and Facebook pages. They go to see where you've been and what you've been doing on the web, because they figure that's going to give them a truer and more candid picture of who you are than the way that you present yourself in the face-to-face interview. So that's something that you really should be aware of, because whatever you put up there can come back to haunt you down the road. It's so tempting. It feels private, you know, because you're just in your room by yourself talking to your friends, but it's also very, very public. Yeah, Meryl.
I know on a lot of these websites there are privacy settings where you can, you know, block people out that aren't your friend or part of your same network. But how private is that really?
You know, it's good to be aware of that. Thank you.
David, I want to speak to this point because I think that these tools are far more dangerous than we realize, that they push consumerism, that information is being gathered about you that can be used against you at a time in history when the American economy is failing, and troops have been brought back from Iraq to deal with civil disorder in this country. We have a president, candidate, who has been threatened publicly, where people say, hang him, kill him. And that's been put out on the TV, and the Secret Service has not intervened. Secret Service is supposed to protect every candidate running. So when they're at one candidate's rally, and some of those people threaten that candidate, and we sit by, we are in danger by this technology. Computers were invented by the military. They are the number one weapon of mass destruction, of mass distraction. You can't have high technology weapons without computers. We get crumbs. We're bought off. We're distracted from each other. We're moved into sharing yourself with the world, but not with each other intimately. Beware of all the things that these technology, as you can tell, David and I take a different view. You know, and I appreciate his integrity in this work and his commitment to it and finding the good part of it. And there are good parts of it. I do not mean to deny that. But as you can see, I feel very passionate. I root this work back to my graduate studies with Eric Fromm, a great psychologist of the 20th century, who wrote about necrophilia, machines rather than biophilia, the attachment to people. I'm about to start, instead of getting away from the students who are walking on campus texting and listening to their cell phone and out of touch, you know, I walk around so they won't bump into me. I'm about not to stop my natural movement to defend their right to walk around and be distracted. The consequences of this distraction from what's happening in America are very serious. And technology is at the root of the absence of the sacred. Our technological capacity has continued. Our ethical capacity has withered. And that's why we find ourselves in this society that is degenerating, that is disintegrating. I mean, I have friends who are retired who just got their retirement plan. They've lost 50% of it. This is all related. People are buying toys and gadgets rather than doing the basic human thing of loving each other. So I use email. I get 100 emails today. So this is a complicated situation, but I wanted to make very clear where I stand on this. And next week I'll probably work between now and then to bring back a reading list for you so you can see the intellectual roots of the critique of technology and why that's important. And I think you indicate a lot of that when you were presenting it, the consumer, the marketing thing, and to wake us up to some of those dangers. And I appreciate that.
Yeah, great. I can't argue with what you've said. I mean, all of that is there and is part of the picture. There is a book called Autonomous Technology that's very good. I think that's the title. The Whale and the Reactor is another amazing book that talks about the dark side of technology. Does anybody want to react to or comment to Shepard's remarks? Yes.
My name is Matt. I was just going to say that it's kind of hard for people in our age group to avoid the technology because we're almost forced to adapt to the technology and use it like in the workplace and stuff like that. So it's kind of hard for us to get away from it when we're constantly being pushed to keep up to date on it. So
that's a good point. Yeah, it's not like you could just choose to be a hermit.
Yeah.
Right. A technological hermit would be
you'd
be dooming yourself to irrelevance. So that really underscores, you know, what I was talking about. In some ways, society is driving this. The technology is driving it. One of those books that I mentioned, I forget which one. There's another one I'm always blocking on it, but you would know this guy. Oh, well.
The guy, Technopoly, Neil Potsdam, because we have a poster.
Yeah, that's a good one, too.
We have a poster in the psychology wing on the third floor that you can go, and it addresses some of his, as a picture of him.
Yeah, that's a very good one as well. There's another one I'm thinking of, and I'm blocking on it right now. But one example that was given is that when you look at nuclear technology, for example, it dictates certain things. Because nuclear technology is so dangerous, it dictates a kind of a political and social reality in which you have to have a military force and something of almost of a police state to guard this very, very dangerous material. So it's not neutral. It, in and of itself, it dictates certain things. Now, one of the critiques that was mentioned in the article is Google making us stupid. A lot of the recent brain research shows that our brains are far more plastic. That is, in the sense of being malleable, adaptable, continuing to learn even late into life. Our brains are, the actual structure of the brain changes based on experience, the things on the ways that we're using it. So it raises the question of how is all of this technology and the ways that we're interacting with it contrasted to the things that we used to do in the past? In what ways is that creating a new and different brain? And so it causes me to wonder, and I think there's research out there that might sort of support it, move in this direction, to wonder if the increase that we're seeing in hyperactivity and so on, ADD, ADHD, if that's any way, in part at least, driven by technology, driven by TV watching, driven by more and more interaction and time spent with computers. I see a hand up here. And again, your big voice for the whole classroom.
Sure. I just wanted to mention that you brought up ADD and how it's developed. They're doing a lot of research now that in children, when they're watching TV or playing video games, a lot of times that actually triggers ADD because it makes them focus in on the moving objects. And so their mind becomes used to the fact that it always has to be moving, always has to be, you know, changing, or like race car games or anything like that. So then for them to sit down and read a book, they can't do it.
Yes. Yes. One of the other questions that I wanted to ask you guys is, how many of you have read a book of 500 pages or more for pleasure that was not assigned to you in school? Show of hands. Okay, so maybe about 8 or 9 or 10 people raised their hand. So maybe about a quarter to a third of this group here. I think that's a sea change. I think that's a definite change from what we would have found in a college classroom. I didn't ask that question before 30 years ago. If I could go back in time, I'd be interested to see if it were different. I suspect, though, that because I know the effect for me of sitting in front of the computer is I don't like to read a whole lot on the computer. There's something about it. I don't know what it is about it, but I just can't read a whole lot. If I hit a long article on the computer, as I frequently do, I try to skim it. And I see heads nodding, you know, I see that matches your experience. And so we become adept at skimming, at nibbling little bites. And in a way, this technology has driven us to the place where that's the skill that you have to develop in order to stay afloat. As you were saying, you've got to kind of be technologically adept, you know, to survive today. And one of the things that you need to do then is to be a good skimmer, nibbler, gatherer of info. So it's definitely a double-sided coin or a sword that cuts both ways. I don't know what the best metaphor is. To me, this iPhone is the most amazing thing. On the one hand, you know, there's everything that Shepard said, all of his very legitimate warnings about distraction, etc. Counterbalanced against that is the fact that I have a device, you know, here in my pocket that I can hold in my hand that's a portal to just about all of human knowledge and all of human wisdom. I mean, I can find ancient Buddhist texts, right, through the window of this device, because all of that stuff is on the web, and I can get onto the web. So there's that paradox of there's so much access, and it is so available. It's so close to hand, and at the same time, it's so much. It's too big. It's overwhelming that we run the risk of becoming what one person called pancake people, which I thought was an interesting metaphor. Let me just read you a little bit here from this article. He says, if we lose those quiet spaces or fill them up with content, we will sacrifice something important not only in ourselves but in our culture. In a recent essay, the playwright Richard Foreman eloquently described what's at stake, and then here's the quote from Richard Foreman. I come from a tradition of Western culture in which the ideal, my ideal, was the complex, dense, and cathedral-like structure of the highly educated and articulate personality, a man or woman who carried inside themselves a personally constructed and unique vision of the entire heritage of the West. But now I see within us all, myself included, the replacement of complex inner density with a new kind of self, evolving under the pressure of information overload and the technology of the instantly available. And then the author says, as we are drained of our inner repository of dense cultural inheritance, Foreman concluded we risk turning into pancake people, spread wide and thin as we connect with the vast network of information accessed by the mere touch of a button. A comment. Any comments, reactions? Yeah.
In the handouts there, I included a Stanford study on computer addiction. I think it's a really primary addiction in society today. And I think some of the things that happens is it subdues feelings and speeds up movements that you become technologized, you become more robot-like, you become more machine-like. You move at a pace that is not organic, it's not human. And that's the overwhelm that you're talking about, the system. The adrenaline pumps, and people get so connected to the machine, to the object. And I think this has caused a massive change in non-indigenous, non-traditional societies. We have computerized society. And I think this is a reason that America is falling in part, and that other societies that are outside this, that are more indigenous, more traditional, are thriving, are continuing. And I think we're facing a time that we've overpopulated the planet so that people will consume more and be objects and fit in as objects rather than as subjects able to cause their destiny. And I think the pancake image is one good image, because I don't think you can get so much knowledge and wisdom from those sources. I think you get data and information, but without the capacity to digest it, to do critical thinking, without those capacities, that's what enables it. At an ethical, moral system, some way of framing it that points beyond you in your individual pleasure to the society of which you are a citizen or a part. And without that, the glue is missing. The web that connects us is missing. And there's this fundamental dislocation, as Chelis Glendening says in her book, "My name is Chelis and I'm recovering from Western civilization." It's that fundamental disconnection from the earth. And the result of that is that we can push buttons to kill a million people and not get it in our body. Warfare used to be conflict and fight where you looked face to face. And so there wasn't that loss, massive loss of life. So I think that the trajectory of this in the future, as you were talking about, is very dangerous.
Well, let me talk a little bit about the trajectory in the future, which probably for you will be a nightmare scenario and maybe for all of us. But there is a important writer, thinker, inventor by the name of Ray Kurzweil, who's put forth the notion of what he calls the singularity. And the notion is that computing power is increasing exponentially, and the cost is decreasing exponentially, so that by 2029, computing power to simulate a human brain will cost about a dollar. This is what is being asserted. Furthermore, it's asserted that in 2040, artificial intelligence will be a billion times more powerful than all human intelligence combined. Singularity is this point where computer intelligence exceeds human intelligence, and we can't predict what's going to happen next. Do the machines replace us, or do we merge? Do the machines amplify us, as they're doing today? Or does the web become an extension of our brain? I like to say that Google is a prosthesis for my brain, because there are things that I forget, but I can find it quickly on Google. This happened just the other day, where I was in conversation with somebody and I was trying to remember the name of this famous MD who was very famous in psychology, a guy by the name of John Lilly, who studied dolphins and took LSD and swam with the dolphins on LSD. And I couldn't think of his name, but I went to Google and I typed in, I think I could remember John. John Dolphins LSD, and it came up right away, John Lilly. So that's like, you know, like a crutch for a broken leg. That's a crutch, a prosthesis for my brain. Now, to give you an even more vivid example of that, and a friend sent this to me online, a link to an article in Esquire, I think probably the current issue, about a young man who was in a very bad automobile accident that tore him up very badly physically. Well, they put him together enough that he's able to sort of physically survive, but greatly handicapped, and he suffers from what's known as locked-in syndrome. Did you see the movie The Butterfly and the Diving Bell and the Butterfly by any chance? Well, I saw it. I sort of didn't want to see it because I knew what it was about, and I thought, ooh, it's such a scary concept, although the movie was beautiful and well done. And in fact, the movie, the script, the movie was based on a book, and the book was written by this locked-in guy. And it's a Frenchman who, as a result of an automobile accident, got paralyzed, everything except for his eyes. He could move his eyes up and down and left and right. And he couldn't talk. He couldn't move any other part of his body. And yet, he was fully aware, lucid, conscious. So that's what they mean by locked in. You become a prisoner within your own body with no ability to communicate with the outside world, except somebody who noticed. It's an astounding story. Somebody noticed, you know, that he had this eye movement and was patient enough to spend the time to teach him to do eye signals to, and then she had an alphabet, and she would sit there and move her finger, pointing at each letter. And then he would signal, stop at that letter. And in that very painstaking, tedious way, he wrote a whole book, a whole beautiful memoir about his whole experience and his relationships and so on. So a fully conscious, sentient being locked in. Now, there are a number of such cases. And so this article in Esquire talks about some scientists who are working with this young man who is locked in, and they've attached electrodes to his skull, and we're not at this point able to read minds in that way. But what they have figured out is that they can map different brain patterns to match up to phonemes. You know, phonemes are, and you probably can define a phoneme better than I can. No? Shaking your head. The phonemes are the units of speech, the different sounds that we're able to make in English. And so it's like, they're probably more than the 26 letters, but it's definitely a finite set. It's probably, there might be like 40 or 50 phonemes in English, I'm guessing. And so they're still in the process, but they've made rudimentary steps. It's clear that this is going to succeed, that this young man will eventually be able to talk by picking up these patterns from his brain, who would be otherwise totally locked in. So it's a remarkable story. And you'll find it in Esquire, I think, the current issue. Or you find it online if you want to. The name of the article is The Unspeakable Odyssey of the Motionless Boy. So, you know, we have both kinds of things going on. Comments? Where am I in relation to the amount of time that I said I was going to be here?
10
about 10 more minutes. You know, we were talking about Facebook before, and there was an article in the newspaper this past week about Facebook for babies. I don't know if you follow the Press Democrat or not, but there are
get them hooked early on,
hey? Huh?
Get them hooked
early on. Well, it's really, yeah, it is about getting them hooked early on. There's Kid Mondo, there's O Daddy-O, and Tot Spot. O Daddy-O's for dads. And at this early on, it's the parents entering things in for their children. So for little toddlers, and I think sometimes they do it in the voice of the toddler, you know. So I pooped my diaper today, but you know, I don't know what they write. But sort of it would be like an alternative to the baby book, maybe, that your mom and dad kept for you. Maybe you have a baby book at home. Well, now it would be online, and the big selling point is then so that the relatives in Iowa can all stay abreast of what's happening and follow the events on your life. And also the parents are also, they're lining up future play dates. They're finding other kids that they think would be a good match for their kids. It's a very interesting phenomenon, I think. And of course, there's always a commercial motivation behind it. Somebody's hoping to clean up and make a lot of money. Well, you know, you, Shepherd, you made reference to what's going on now with all the bad news that we're experiencing in the newspapers and the stock market. And I'm one of those people that had some money in the market, you know, that I was going to be part of my retirement, and I'm biting my nails. So I'm wondering for you young folks here, how you're coping with this. How are you coping with all the bad news that you're being bombarded with?
I kind of think it's a motivator because like none of us really have dealt with any of this before, so I feel like we're all being like awakened to it, and it's like motivating me to try and like make a difference.
Okay, so can you say more about make a difference and motivated to do what?
Just kind of like with the environment, with the like not so much I guess with the economy, because I don't really know exactly how it would make a difference yet, but like with the environment, like now they're selling like corn cups just made out of like corn, and like buying those, or I don't know, like buying organic food, buying like locally grown food, and supporting like the local community.
Okay, thank you. What about others of you? Is what you're seeing in the newspapers, is it getting you down? Is it not getting you down? What do you do to keep yourself motivated and up?
Well, in this class, we've been actually talking about that topic, and a lot of us were pretty scared about everything that's been going on. One thing is Shepherd made a point a couple of classes ago about how many students there are in colleges, And if we all came together as one, we're a lot more powerful than we are by ourselves. So that was a big thing to me, to think about everyone around me. And a lot of people think that their vote doesn't really matter, at least like the kids that I know. So it's kind of neat to when I walked outside the other day, there was a bunch of people sitting on a booth talking about voting, and it does really matter. And even if you vote for someone who's not Republican or Democrat, you like, your vote still matters. And I don't know, I think it's really important to all of us have our eyes awakened and see what's really going on.
Okay, good for you. So yeah, this is a wake-up call of some sort, and definitely creates opportunities for action and for, I'm wondering if, you know, what are your personal survival strategies? I mean, for me, it's kind of mindfulness, bringing myself into the present, not catastrophizing about the future, trying to remember that, hey, we're all here, right? We're all here. We all have the knowledge and abilities, and everything that we have is here, whether the money's here or not. So none of that is lost. And the trick is to not go into a panic, I think. Yes.
I just wanted to add to what you were saying, a big thing for me, because I do feel a lot of despair about what's happening, but a big thing for me is practicing gratitude and just even the simplest things. Like, I love petting my cat. There are things that, you know, the breakdown of the economy aren't going to affect. I love nature. I love looking out up at a tree in the fall. So things like that.
Okay, great. Anybody else want to say anything before we wrap this up? Good.
Well, I just want to make a comment. It's not really relevant to what you're talking about, but I do want to comment on what Meryl has said about information on the web. It's nothing safe. If you put anything out there, even the most benign thing you put on the web is going to be tangible to somebody to hack into, to read when you get into grad school. Right now, I'm trying to get into grad school, and I don't even want to say my name right now because I want to make sure that my identity is concealed, so, because that information could potentially be used against me. And I think right now we're at a point where we've reached a dichotomy of the web's really good. We are access to everything. We can have it right away. But then it could also be used against us, as I said. And I just want to know what everybody thinks about the idea that Big Brother is watching us now.
Yes.
There was this guy I knew in high school, and he ended up getting suspended because of something he put on the internet, so it's really not private at all.
What about the Big Brother question that was just raised? Is that of concern to you? I see a nodding head. Maybe I can get you to say something on the mic.
Yeah, it's a big concern. I feel like we're we've lost a lot of our rights that were afforded to us in the Bill of Rights. And with what we put on the internet, it can be used against us. It was just in the news yesterday how the NSA was listening to phone calls from people in Iraq talking to their family back home. And, you know, it happens more than we think, and it's frightening.
Yes, I have to agree with you about that. Okay, well, this is not the highest note to end on, but I think we have come to a natural end. So I want to thank you all for putting up with me and being good listeners and being willing to talk and put it out there on the internet. I have to confess feeling self-conscious about putting this one out as a podcast. I left out some of the points I had intended to make, and I wasn't nearly as cogent as I like to imagine myself to be. It's generally hard, I guess, listening to oneself, and I'm hoping that I'm being too self-critical. Again, I apologize for the buzzing of the iPhone. For any future in-person interviews, I'll know to either turn the iPhone off or to put it into what they call airport mode. That was the maiden voyage using my new Marantz PMD620 digital recorder, which I purchased at the recent New Media Expo in Las Vegas. I really like this recorder, but did learn that it's very susceptible to interference from the iPhone. I also noticed that the background noise level would come up when any of us spoke into the external microphone that I was using. I don't think you heard much of that just now because I tried to remove as much of it as possible in post-production. I'll have to experiment some more to figure out what's going on with that. I have two theories. I think it may have been caused either by the fluorescent lighting in the classroom or maybe by feedback from the little speaker inside the recorder itself. Or once again, maybe it was due to some weird interaction with the iPhone. But I will get to the bottom of that issue.
You're on the couch again with Dr. Dave. And Shrink Wrap Radio is playing on again. Yeah. It's all in your head. It's all in your head. Shrink Wrap Radio. Shrink Wrap Radio. Shrink Wrap Radio. Shrink Wrap Radio. It's Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head.
If you haven't gotten around to it yet, there's a wonderful interview on my other podcast series at www.wisecounselpodcast.com. It's an inspiring conversation with Frank Ockbird, MD, on post-traumatic stress disorder, and it's one of those special interviews where I felt a really strong sense of rapport with Frank. I want to thank everyone who's made a $20 PayPal donation by running a little ad for their blog on our Top Spots widget, which you'll find in the upper right-hand corner of the Shrink Wrap Radio web pages. The Top Spots widget on our site is a place where you can help support the show and advertise your blog, your website, or service at the same time, all for a mere $20 PayPal donation. Whether you run an ad there or not, be sure to check out the folks that are advertising there, and maybe you'll discover something of interest to you. Thanks to all of you who've taken advantage of the discount offers from our four sponsors. You find links on our website to discounts at GoDaddy, Brookstone.com, Budget.com, Car Rentals, and PetMeds.com. Using those codes not only saves you money, but also helps to support Shrink Wrap Radio. For example, most of us run into a situation where we need to rent a car from time to time. It might be due to business or vacation travel, or because your car's in the shop. Whatever the reason, you can get $30 off weekly rentals or 10% off any other time periods. There are over 900 budget locations in the U.S. alone, and you have the option of getting a Garmin GPS with your rental. You can use the discount code SHRINK or just click on the links that you'll find on our website at shrinkwrapradio.com.
Hey, Dr. Dave, just wanted to say love your show. I was wanting to send you an email, but to contact you on your Shrink Wrap Radio podcast show, it says email shrink@shrinkwrap.com and the Shrink Wrap, shrinkwrapradio.com, and it's not an actual address, so I'm not sure if that's an error, and I'm just having trouble finding a place where I can actually just send you an email. All right, excellent. Again, love your show, and I'll keep listening. Okay, thanks. Bye.
Well, I'm not sure who that was from, but thanks for leaving the recording and for the vote of confidence. I'm not sure what the problem was, but yes, shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com is a valid email address, and that's how you can reach me. I get lots of emails there. Remember, though, wrap is spelled R-A-P and not W-R-A-P. Now let's catch up on some of those back emails. First, we hear from Harmony, who writes, "Hi, Dr. Dave. I only discovered your show about 1 week ago and have been enjoying browsing through the archives and listening to some of the shows that seem most interesting. I just did your survey. I marked your interview skills as somewhat satisfying instead of very satisfying. I wanted to note that I perhaps should have put very satisfied. Your interview skills in general are very good, but the reason I put that I am only somewhat satisfied is just because, as I explained in the survey, I'm far left politically. So for something to get an A-plus grade from me, I want to hear certain questions asked, questions that a far leftist like me might ask. But in retrospect, it's unfair to deduct marks from your interview skills per se for this. Overall, I enjoy listening to your show. I'm glad I found it and plan on telling my partner about it. You'll probably hear from me in the future after I've listened to more of your shows. Namaste, Harmony. Harmony, thank you very much for that feedback. You know, I kind of lean over backwards not to be political because I don't want to. I need all the listeners I can get. And I don't want to alienate listeners who might have different politics than I do. Some of my guests, for example, my friend Jerry Trumbull, he's much more forthright than I am. Shepherd Bliss, who you heard on this discussion here earlier, he's also much more forthright. And if you listen between the lines, I think people can probably tell which way I tend to lean. But I try to be as welcoming and non-confrontational in my interviewing as possible. And that's just me. That's just who I am. But I'm so glad that you found the show, and I hope that you will continue to listen. Next, we hear from Nir in New York City. Nir is the one who created our opening and closing theme music. And Nir writes, "Hi, Dr. Dave. Once again, an amazing program with Dr. Dana Houck. This is a great example of how to relate to and treat evil in the world by letting it be expressed and brought into consciousness in an appropriate container. The work Dr. Houck did with the groups cuts through all of the falseness and gets down to the core, which is true and real in all of us, connecting people inside prison and out. He's definitely the real thing. I agree with you 100%. Also, I've been a listener of Armand DeMille for quite some time and would love to hear you both talking to each other. I'm sure you would enjoy listening to his programs as well at The Positive Mind. Thanks, Nir." Nir is of course, referring to the interview that I did recently with Dana Houck, who worked in the prison system using a Jungian approach in Minnesota. And I got a couple of emails and comments about that interview, and I think people really related to Dr. Houck. I certainly did, and particularly to his use of myth and fairy tale. And so I've sent off an invitation to him that I would like to interview him again with a particular focus on having him share some more with us around his use of myth and fairy tale from a Jungian perspective. So I'm looking forward to that. And I did download a podcast of Armand DeMille, who has a radio show in New York City called The Positive Mind, which is available both on air and as a podcast. And I gather he's been doing this for about 20 years. So he's a very well-known public radio figure and talks very well about mental health issues. Seems to be a very wise and experienced therapist. And perhaps I'll have him on at some point. I'm not exactly sure what we would talk about, but I will definitely take that under advisement. So thanks for that suggestion, Nir. The next one's from Rachel, who's one of our top spot widget advertisers, contributors. She's got handmade gifts, which would be great holiday gifts. So check her out on our top spot site. At any rate, Rachel writes, "Hi, Dr. Dave. I've been thinking lately that it would be good to hear an interview with someone on the topic of harm reduction as well as motivational interviewing /stages of change with reference to addiction treatment. This is really where all the action is in the field right now. I've been working with dual diagnosed addicts for about 7 years, the past 5 with the homeless population in Los Angeles." Well, good for you. That is noble work, I must say. And she goes on to say, "And in that short time, have really seen a dramatic shift in how addiction treatment is conducted and, albeit more slowly, how it is viewed from a legal perspective, as well with the passing of Prop 36, treatment instead of jail for the first time nonviolent offenders in California. There's a huge harm reduction movement in the Bay Area and some wonderful people up there that may make good guests. A psychologist by the name of Pat Denning comes to mind. She has a couple of books out. One is called Practicing Harm Reduction Psychotherapy, an Alternative Approach to Addictions. I think she resides in Oakland. Thanks for your time and contribution to the field, Rachel." Well, Rachel, thank you for those suggestions. And in fact, I've contacted Pat Denning and she has agreed to be my guest. I decided it would be most appropriate to have her on my Wise Counsel series. So I will be interviewing her this coming week for Wise Counsel. And then I intend to follow up with another interview, probably also for Wise Counsel, on motivational interviewing. So those are both great suggestions, and I'm taking them both to heart immediately. So I think that better wrap it up for today. Remember, you can send your emails to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. And in addition to emails, you can leave comments about individual shows in the comments area on the site. You can send me voice recordings, transcriptions. You can leave those on Skype, or you can send MP3 files, or there's a little logo on our site for MyChango that lets you record if you have a mic on your computer, and most people do these days. And in the U.S., you can leave voicemail on our phone at 206-337-0622. Thanks to Shepherd Bliss for inviting me to his class, and to the students who spoke up, and to those who didn't. If all goes as planned, next week's guest will be Dr. James Wanless, and we'll be talking about intuition in business and also about the tarot deck he designed. So until then, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind. Thank you.